part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm not doing part. Fanboy.com.
Well, thank you. Thank you for joining me. I appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, no, thanks very much. I mean, it's, I love to, any chance I get to kind of, talk comics and talk what I'm up to is great.
Well, absolutely. And, it's great having you on. It's been like 3 years since I've had either of you guys on or probably even seen you at New York Comic Con. For anyone listening, my name is Christian Horn. This is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. And I have on the line Connor McCreary, who is the co-creator of a comic series that I have grown to love throughout the years called Kill Shakespeare. Correct?
Yes.
Among other things.
Oh, yes.
But yeah, it's been several years since I've had either of you on the podcast. And I guess I just sort of lost track of what you guys were up to and what you guys were doing. And I got an email maybe about a month, or maybe a little longer than that. I'd been kind of keeping track of what you guys had sort of been doing, but I hadn't seen any new Kill Shakespeare stuff. And so when I got the email about this project, I got very excited.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, it's we've taken a little bit of a break, I guess, for those of you out there who may not be kind of familiar with what Kill Shakespeare is, the idea behind it, it's kind of like if Game of Thrones and Shakespeare had a drunken one-night stand. we're the illegitimate babies. So it's this action-adventure story that takes all of Shakespeare's characters and puts them in the same world. So, Hamlet can meet Juliet, or Lady Macbeth can be in bed, literally and figuratively with Richard III. And all the characters are pit against each other on this quest to end all tragedy by either killing or saving this mysterious figure named William Shakespeare.
Yes.
We've done a number of books in the series, but it had been a little while, I think almost 2 years between the fourth book of the series and this book, Past His Prologue, Juliet, which is sort of a flashback story that sheds more light on sort of the origin story of one of our most popular characters, which is Juliet, who when you meet in Kill Shakespeare the first time around, it's sort of like 5 or 6 years after her ordeal with Romeo, and she's survived, and she's become this sort of leader of a rebellion against Richard III. This book answers the question a lot of our fans had, which is, wait, how did that happen? How did she go from that girl at the end of the play to this woman who leads a rebellion? So that's kind of what, that's kind of what I've been working on in the Kill Shakespeare universe, among a couple other things with Anthony to kind of keep our nerdy Shakespeare passion burning.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I realized that I pulled my Kill Shakespeare books off the shelf. I have 1 through 3, and then I just looked at this and I realized that this was book 5, and I think I may have, I'm looking at the cover online and I'm like, no, this looks really familiar. I think I read The Mask of Night, and I may have even reviewed it or maybe even chatted with one of you about it. I can't remember, but I was blown away by that. This was like volume 5 already. I was like, wow, these guys have done a lot of this Kill Shakespeare stuff.
Yeah, no, it's something we started back, I guess. And I mean, the original idea came to us way back in, kind of just around 2001, 2002, and we were kind of just goofing. Kill Bill was out at the time. We made a joke about, hey, what if we try to kill a different Bill? And that became Billy Shakespeare, and that's kind of where the original idea for the comic came. But we weren't quite sure what to do with it at the time, and so we sort of put it in the back pocket for a while. But I think like any really good idea, or at least an idea that wants you to do it, I'll leave it up to you guys to decide how good an idea it is. Yeah. But, I think those ideas kind of stay with you. And this idea just kept whispering at Anthony and I, saying like, hey, when are you going to do me? When are you going to get this done? When are you going to write me? And, it wasn't until kind of 2009, 2010 that we started to put out the first issues of Kill Shakespeare. It's been a while. I mean, it's a book we put out amongst other work. I mean, Anthony and I have done stuff. We've done the Assassin's Creed series with Titan, and we did a Holmes versus Houdini series with Dynamite.
Yeah.
Anthony did a really cool Nancy Drew Hardy Boys thing for Dynamite as well, and I've been doing some Adventure Time and some regular show stuff with Boom. And we both have original graphic novel projects that are kind of in the hopper, both which will be announced next year. So, you know, we've tried to keep really busy, but Kill Shakespeare's always been kind of the passion project.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I know that I'd seen the Assassin's Creed stuff and I'd seen the Sherlock stuff, but there was definitely a part of me that was wondering, I don't know why, I was like, oh, is the band breaking up? Because I was thinking that maybe Anthony, like he had gone off to do the Hardy Boys thing and the Nancy Drew thing on his own. And then when I got this, you had kind of... it says that you wrote this one by yourself. And so I was a little worried. I was like, oh, is the band breaking up? Like what's happening?
No, you know, it was just kind of a timing thing. I mean, Anthony had the Hardy Boys opportunity. And we were kind of sitting there being like, you know, we got to do something with Kill Shakespeare. And we didn't necessarily want to move, like, because this is a flashback story, it's a good way to kind of get into the book or the series kind of fresh, right? You can read this one, you know, 100 page odd graphic novel, and if you like what we're doing with this, you're gonna like everything else. And so we didn't want to keep building on to the main storyline if it was only going to be sort of one of us. But you know, basically what we did is what we normally do, which is the two of us work together to figure out what is the story going to be. I mean, I brought a few ideas to Anthony, and then he kind of sat there and said, hey, well, what if we tried this? Or I think maybe we're missing something here. And then we worked it a little more. And then normally what we do at that point is we just divvy up issues. You know, I write evens, he writes odds, whatever the case may be.
Oh, interesting.
But because this time around, he was right in the middle of all the Hardy Boys stuff. He just didn't think he was going to have the time to properly dedicate to it. And, you know, so I just kind of, it was actually kind of a bit of a throwback to when we first started, where when we first worked together, Anthony was a bit more of kind of a producer type. That was his background actually in film and television, and I had more of a writing background. And so in the first couple of books of Kill Shakespeare, while we did all the story plotting and everything together, and we both looked through every script together, I did more of the boots on the ground writing for those first couple of books, just because that was sort of something I was more comfortable with. And then as Anthony kind of got more in the writer's saddle, you know, we just started dividing everything up evenly, you know. So it was weird. It was a throwback to, you know, I was thinking back to almost 10 years ago, sitting in this easy chair in this old place I had, you know, writing out scripts longhand on foolscap kind of thing. So it was bittersweet. It was nice to kind of have that chance to sort of stretch your legs, but it was weird not to constantly have him there to help make the story better.
Sure, sure. Well, I don't know that that's a concern, because I mean, I've read it and I reread it recently just to get ready for our interview. And I have to say, like, this is definitely one of my favorites for some reason. I really, really enjoyed it. And for anyone listening, the book is actually called Kill Shakespeare, Past His Prologue, Juliet. And I think that you're very much on the nose when you say that somebody, I think particularly somebody who, you know, has read some Shakespeare, and that was like years and years ago, and is not an expert at like what every character is and every character does or whatever. This to me seemed like the most accessible and the biggest sort of like jumping on, like you said, without any like previous knowledge of whatever your stories are of Shakespeare, that you could just jump in and enjoy it.
Yeah, and that was kind of the intention. I mean, I think one of the things that's really cool about having, you know, four or five, et cetera, books in a series is, you know, you see them on a shelf and you're like, wow, okay, cool. This is going to be something I can really sink my teeth into. But it can also be a bit intimidating. And so we wanted to find a way to get people into it easily. And Romeo and Juliet as a play is, I would say, you know, I think it's the most well-known play. Everybody knows Romeo and Juliet, even if you've never read it. If I said to you, hey, it's a Romeo and Juliet story, right away, you know, there's tragic love. There's something about families who don't like each other. You know, those things we just know, it's like a cultural touchstone. And So yeah, we want, you know, I'm glad you had that reaction, because that's exactly what I was hoping. Is I was really hoping this would be a really easy book for anybody to get into. And it's also different than anything we've done in Kill Shakespeare. I mean, one of the fun things about doing Kill Shakespeare is that Shakespeare had so many different genres within his work, and we get to do a bunch of different things. I mean, the first couple of books, there are this big quest story. The third book is this weird kind of psychological horror. The fourth book is the swashbuckling pirate adventure. And then this fifth book is, you know, it's kind of like John Wick if Juliet was in the lead.
Yeah.
You know, in every way you would think of that, you know. And it's a mentorship story, and it's about a young woman kind of figuring out how to channel her passion and her anger at what's happened in her life outward rather than inward. You know, it's probably the biggest character study we've done, and I'm really, you know, we've had really good response to it. So we're hoping that we'll be able to do more of these, because our fans do come in and say, hey, like, you know, the whole game of Kill Shakespeare is sort of taking these characters from a part of their play and then spinning them in this new direction, like Juliet living or Hamlet never getting back home. And, you know, that often creates people asking questions like, well, but how, like, what happened in the gap between the play and your story? And I think we'd like to do a lot more of these, from, you know, looking maybe into more about Othello to, I'd love to do one with Falstaff, who's one of my favorite characters. I'd love to do one maybe kind of after the end of our story, where we kind of deal with his ghost and all the illegitimate children I am sure he has fathered across this land. I'm kind of thinking like Nick Fury and his Howling Commandos, but with Ghost Falstaff and his illegitimate children.
That's great. That's totally great. That sounds fantastic. So, but this one is sort of what I really loved about it too, is it's very much like a vengeance tale. Like it reminded me very much of, well, you know, you even said Kill Bill, the movie, but also, you know, this sort of like 70s aesthetic, where 70s, 80s, where it's sort of, and this is to the extreme, where it's sort of like a death wish or something like that, where a character has been wronged, or even like, say, something more recently, like Netflix, The Punisher, where it's like a character's been wronged. And obviously this is not as extreme as that. That's an extreme example. But I tend to sort of gravitate towards those sort of tales where it's like someone's been wronged and it's like they have to sort of get their revenge and the quest that it takes them on.
Yeah, and I thought that would be kind of an interesting thing in, you know, like people look at Juliet and I think Juliet kind of sometimes gets a bad rap. People think she's this very kind of frail, almost foolish character, right? Because it's hard for us to wrap our minds around the idea of like, oh my gosh, her and Romeo knew each other for what, like a week? And yeah, all of a sudden they were in this murder-suicide pact? Like, you know, what the hell is that about? But you know, when you look at the story, there's a lot of little things that show that Juliet's a much tougher, stronger character. Like right at the beginning of her play, there's a bit where her dad wants her to marry this other guy and she says no. Which, you know, nowadays would be an awkward situation. But back then, Juliet's not legally a person, right? Like, she's her dad's property. Uh-huh. And honor killings have a long tradition in Anglo-Saxon history, too. It wouldn't be, European history, it wouldn't be beyond the realm of possibility for Juliet's father to have decided to kill her when she said no. So, I mean, she's a smarter person, or even how she handles, you know, Romeo in the balcony scene. You know, Romeo is very clear about wanting to climb that balcony, and you know, he does think Juliet's great, but he wants to climb that balcony and consummate their love. And Juliet is able to keep him at arm's length without him getting pissy and without him feeling like she doesn't think he's, you know, amazing as well. So she's a very self-possessed young woman. And so, you know, we kind of felt like, how would she feel if you know, if Romeo's dead and she's alive? She's going to be angry, and she's going to need somewhere for that anger to go. And we wanted to, you know, we wanted to give her this quest where she could channel that anger, but also, and I wanted it to, you know, I love those revenge stories as well, but I always feel like, to me, there's a huge difference between like a really great revenge story and then ones like, I'm not interested as much in revenge stories where the hero is just better at killing than the villain, you know. Yeah. And the real good ones really, you know, even though these people are doing these violent things to get revenge, they're still kind of tormented a little bit at some point as to what is the point of it. And a lot of this book is kind of asking the question, well, what is the purpose of revenge? Does it have a purpose? Can it have a purpose? you know, and you know, we tried to, you know, I tried to walk a line where the ultimate villain is punished for what he did, but also do that in a way so that Juliet wouldn't stop being Juliet, who is fundamentally at the end of the day someone who is a lover, I guess, right? Not necessarily, you know, romantically all the time, but someone who really does care about the people in her world.
Yeah. It's interesting that you talk about Juliet being Juliet, because I mean, the reread and the original read when I first got it, it very much strikes me that this is, I mean, you've said that there's a case for her being and there is a case for her being very, you know, a strong woman or a girl or however you want to characterize her, you know, because of her age in the play. But this is very much out of sort of that wheelhouse, don't you think? Like, I mean, this is almost Juliet sort of like as an action hero, correct?
Yeah, a little bit. Because, yeah, when you get to the, you know, when you get to the first book in the series after you've read the fifth one, you know, Juliet is very much, I mean, she's a general, right? She's a leader of men. And I wanted to walk the line where she could take care of herself, but at the same token, like, I also kind of get sick and tired of, like, I, you know, like Jurassic World, for an example, where all of a sudden, like, oh, you know, Chris, you know, his character is, Chris Pratt's character is, it turns out that he's like this ex, you know, Navy Green Beret or Navy SEAL or whatever he is, right?
And you're like, he is at what he does or something like that.
And it's like, well, you know, and I'm like, you're like, would that story maybe not be more interesting if it was a guy who was the science officer who, you know, can take care of himself a little bit, but has to improvise and figure out his skills? And so I didn't want Juliet to kind of be this, you know, crack fighter who knew everything. And that kind of let, you know, I don't want to give anything away here, but that let the other main character in the story kind of have a bigger purpose, which is to sort of serve as this mentor who can take this raw energy that Juliet has and this natural, as it turns out, she has some natural ability to handle herself in a fight, but to kind of give her the pieces she needs to be able to be a bit of an action hero. But really, I mean, I think what makes Juliet the hero is just she's not going to give up. She's going to find a way to make what's wrong right. And on the way by, she's going to have a really negative impact on somebody important to her, but she's going to have a hugely positive impact on another character and change their life. And I think that's kind of that foreshadows to me how this woman is going to go on and become this leader of an army, because she can change people's lives by the way she approaches her life.
Sure. And why did you choose to do sort of a prequel? Because this is a prequel series, correct? This is before the very first, the very first Kill Shakespeare book, right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, so why choose a prequel book? And then my other question would be, why Juliet? I mean, you kind of mentioned earlier that she's sort of one of the most, is she one of the characters that fans have reacted the most to, or?
No, for sure. We get more emails or letters based on Juliet than anybody else. Probably all the other characters combined, even maybe.
Really? I think
Probably because she feels so different. I mean, Hamlet, you know, if you read Kill Shakespeare, you don't have to squint too hard to see Hamlet be Hamlet. And our Falstaff is perhaps a more comedic version of the Falstaff most people are used to. But he's very much, you know, kind of from this one play, Merry Wives of Windsor, portrays Falstaff as sort of this harmless comedic character. And we kind of use that interpretation. And Othello is still Othello, basically. But Juliet seems very different, and I think that really caught a lot of people's imagination. So part of it was that. I mean, it was just people were interested. Part of it is because, to me, as the Kill Shakespeare series has gone on, the first four books, Juliet has kind of gone from being the supporting character in Hamlet's story to, I feel like, as you move through the third and fourth books, the story starts becoming more and more Juliet's. And so I feel like, in a lot of ways, she's become our main character, which is really exciting to me, actually. And so from that perspective, giving, in what is effect now our main character, giving her backstory, I felt made a lot of sense. And even if you kind of still think Hamlet is the main character, which is makes a lot of sense there too, his backstory's kind of already been explained by that first two volumes, right? So,
sure.
She was, I mean, it was because people wanted it and because she feels so important to the series, it made sense. And probably because her story seemed, the idea I had in mind was the most obviously interesting one that I had when I looked at a bunch of the characters. And then, the other thing is that, as to why a prequel, it kind of, like I said before, we wanted to find a way to get people in a new way, probably from a bit of a taking a step back and thinking like the marketing thought side of things. Everybody reads Romeo and Juliet, and so Juliet, the graphic novel, is an easy thing to put into schools or to get teachers kind of interested in, which is always sort of one of our backdoor plans, is to get more and more teachers using Kill Shakespeare to help teach Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it was also, Anthony and I, we wanted to be able to come back to Kill Shakespeare, to the main storyline, together in a more meaningful way than we were going to be able to do at this time. And so Juliet was a way for us to tell a story that I think really does deepen the mythology of the world and is a story I'm very proud of, without pushing our main storyline forward, without both of us being ready to do that together. And that's something that we're hoping to be able to get done. I'm hoping that by the end of this year, or sorry, next year, we'll have everything locked for the next book in the Kill Shakespeare series, which will pick up kind of shortly after where book four left off.
Gotcha. So you won't be approaching volumes after this one, sort of with singular characters? Like, there's no thought as to do that, like to sort of like choose and pick? Like, you had sort of mentioned that you had wanted to do, was it Falstaff, like the character,
yeah,
like on his own? Were there thoughts to doing sort of these like one-offs, more of those, or you just want to continue the story that you had started with the other volumes?
I mean, ideally both. I think it'd be great if we could, every so often, because it gives you some freedom to kind of tell a totally different story and to do something goofy. Anthony has a really fun idea he wants to do for Beatrice and Benedict, which could maybe fit in the main storyline, but could definitely be its own thing. So I think in an ideal world, we would be able to do both. But I mean, we don't want to abandon the central story. It's been a couple of years since we've jumped back on that. And, Juliet is a way to kind of keep our fan base active and to make sure that, to give it way for new fans to get on board. But, ultimately we want to get back to everything we've set up through the first four books. And, I know exactly where I want that to go. And, I know what the final panels are going to look like in the series. The biggest question is just, originally Anthony and I thought we'd get there like four or five books, maybe total. And now we're like, oh, maybe we're just moving into our second act right now. There, it might be a longer series than we realized, just because the story just built out so much more. So, it's an exciting place to be.
Yeah, no, I mean that's excellent. I mean, I'm glad to hear that the sort of narrative is moving forward, and then you guys are coming up with all these amazing ideas. Obviously, Shakespeare has such a large world to play in, correct?
Yeah, and we haven't touched. There's a lot. I mean, there's tons of major characters. I mean, King Lear is one that people constantly ask us about. We get to people ask, Beatrice and Benedict being some of the, we haven't used a ton of the comedies. We've touched on characters like Puck, but we haven't touched on Titania or Oberon, who are sort of the fairy, king and queen. There's a lot of more weird magic stuff we could get into, which would be pretty fun. There's no shortage of really good characters for us to play with. And so, it'll be interesting. And of course, some of the other stuff we're doing is we've also been developing Kill Shakespeare as a television show with NBC and Amazon, which is one of the reasons why the comic stuff had slowed down a bit.
Sure.
And so that's a whole other set of characters and storylines, some of which will be drawn from the comics, but of course, a lot of that stuff ends up being its own thing. So, yeah, we've been fortunate that we've got to spend the last year or so really diving into the world, and that's generated some interesting ideas for the comics specifically.
Oh, that's great. Now you wrote this one pretty much on your own, and it's a female protagonist with a lot of like really great, a couple of strong female characters in there. How did you find, I mean, obviously you've written this character before or worked on this character before. Is it a challenge for you at all to sort of like get into that mindset of sort of like the female protagonist, or how do you sort of approach that being a man?
It's, It's funny, right? Because yeah, you. I mean, on one hand, so like for this one, I was really sad that Andy Boulanger, who has been the artist who did the first four books of Kill Shakespeare, wasn't able to do this book.
Say that the artist that you've got now, what's her name? I love
Corinne Howell. Corinne Howell.
Yeah, is it Corinne? Corinne Howell.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love her. I think she's great. Like, not that I didn't love the artist before, because I did. But I found her to be like a really great breath of fresh air in this book. Like, I loved her paneling. I loved the way the movement of the characters. I loved the expression. I loved, you know, everything about it. And your colorist, too, did a really amazing job on this book. Sorry to interrupt, but
I just had to get that in there. No, Rin is great. She's so talented, and you know, we had a really good time working on this book together, and I'm looking forward to I'm hoping she'll be able to stay with us for a while now. It would be fantastic if she could. So the fact that we went from Andy to Corinne, one of the opportunities that created was the fact that Corinne is, you know, she's a woman. And so that gave, you know, so that was a different person to bounce off of, right? Like, there was a couple of things in the script where I'd be like, hey, how's this landing with you? But I don't find her a super difficult character to write. And in, you were mentioning Assassin's Creed previous, we got that gig. Titan and Ubisoft wanted to kind of have, for the first time, kind of a sole female lead in something that they considered a major part of the canon. Mm-hmm. And we were offered the gig because of the Juliet character. People at Ubisoft and at Titan had read Kill Shakespeare and were like, wow, that Juliet, like, she's such a great character. And so then we got to create this character, Charlotte de la Cruz for Assassin's Creed. And, you know, she's a modern day woman. She was born in kind of like 1998 sort of thing, like she's or 1995, I guess. And she's, you know, she's meant to be a contemporary. And so I was maybe a little more nervous writing her, just because with Juliet, you know, I don't really see a huge difference in writing male and female characters. Really. I mean, I think you just try to write complete people. And I don't tend to think too much gender. Like, I don't have too many moments where I'm like, oh, what would this character do if they were a guy? Like, I don't tend to think that way. And I don't, you know, I just don't. I just kind of like, this is who Juliet is. This is the way she acts. And I mean, I think Anthony and I have been we're very happy that people look at people like our characters, like Juliet and Lady Macbeth. And we have so many female fans who are like, those are great female characters.
Yeah.
And then Charlotte de la Cruz, the same thing. It's a real joy to me when a young woman comes up and is an Assassin's Creed fan and is like, Charlotte de la Cruz is the assassin I always wanted. And, you know, that makes you feel great. You know what I mean? And every once in a while you get nervous. Like, you don't want to, you know, especially I'm not blind to the fact that I'm like, you know, sailing into middle-aged white dude writing these female characters, and that somebody, you know, if I put a foot wrong, it would be easier to criticize. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, at the end of the day, your characters are supposed to feel real. And I just try not to think about the gender thing too much. I honestly don't think it makes that huge a difference in a lot of ways. There are some things specifically that Juliet will do differently because she is a woman. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it always feels more tangential to me. It's never really something that's in my head. It's only after I write it, maybe today, especially in the climate we're in a little bit, I may double check things in a different way than I might have a couple of years ago, where I might have been like, oh yeah, people will get that I'm not trying to, you know, I'm not making some comment about gender here. And now I'm a little more like, well, we're in a slightly more charged time. Let me make sure, you know, and put this out to some women I respect to make sure that something that I don't think is a big deal, that they also agree.
Wow. Yeah, that's interesting that you mentioned the sort of times that we're in, because I mean, that's very much why I really enjoyed this book, that she was a very strong female protagonist, you know, didn't take any guff or nonsense, and really had a really great sort of like learning journey on the way, and didn't necessarily have to have anything, have anything mansplained to her. You know what I mean? I mean, she learns a bit, but it's mostly through her experience.
Yeah, and I thought, like, I mean, I think it's kind of fun that, you know, her and this other, I don't want to spoil anything, but her and this other character have this mentor-mentee relationship. But for everything that he's able to teach her, she's also giving him value back in a different way. And so it's not, on the other hand, too, it's also fun, right? You're totally allowed to have a mentor-mentee relationship. You're totally allowed to have a young woman learn from an older, more experienced man. Like, that's fine. I don't think there's any problem with that. I don't think many readers would say, oh, gosh, yeah, that's innately sexist or problematic. And, you know, and talking about the times we're in is good, I think, because, you know, it may be, you know, I think it makes you raise your game. You can't be lazy, right? Like, you can't sit there and make a dumb comment or a dumb joke, because if it's a dumb joke that's going to be kind of offensive, people are going to call you on it. And, yeah, you know, we're in a space where, why are you telling dumb, offensive jokes, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, there's, we just don't need to do that. Be a smarter, better writer. And so I think even though sometimes the world we're in, or the kind of climate we're in, can feel like it's highly charged, I don't know if it's highly charged. I just think people are just not, they're just not letting dumb stuff pass anymore. And that's, mm-hmm, that's good for all of us, ultimately. You know, I hope that the conversations around it can stay productive and cordial, but I don't ever have a problem with somebody reaching out to me and saying, hey, you know, I think you might have missed the boat here, because, sure, A, it gives me a chance to learn, and B, you know, it's always opinion. And, you know, I've had people weigh in on stuff and say, hey, I think this is great. And then somebody else is like, I don't think that's great. And neither of them are wrong. It's, yeah, just some of it comes down to personal taste at the end of the day, too.
Sure, sure, sure. Well, you know, but for a man, I mean, and not to get too deep into the weeds on this, it is a real skill to be able to write believable and interesting and strong female character. It is something that some people have to kind of develop, right? I mean, but I think that, you know, it seems, you seem very open to being able to look at, you know, a character of the opposite gender and inhabit their shoes.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. And again, you know, I think at the end of the day, you know, like you said, not to get too deep in the weeds to it, but I think, like, you know, I think if you can write a compelling male character, there's no reason you can't write a compelling female character. At the end of the day, men and women are not, in my mind at least, are not, you know, I mean, Juliet is a character who...
They're not what? They're not, you blanked out a little bit, sorry.
Oh, I said, so, you know, at the end of the day, they're not that different, right? Like, I just, you know, when people are like, oh my, you know, and I'm very flattered when people say you write interesting and compelling female characters that I like to read. That makes me feel really good, you know, but for me at the end of the day, that's just trying to do good character work. And I think if you think too much about, oh my gosh, this person, you know, I'm a guy and I'm writing a female, or I'm a Chinese male and I'm writing a white male, or I'm a white male and I'm writing a black female, like, you know, I think you have to be very careful that you're not going to use those characters to make commentary about what it's like to be a black female or a white male or something else if you're not them.
Yeah.
But, you know, Juliet is not making this book is not about her making some statement about what it's like to be a woman. It's just,
sure,
hopefully a really great adventure for a woman. And I think as long as you don't try to speak for somebody that is not you, you're fine. And yeah, you know, I think they're just characters, they're just people, and you try to find what makes them interesting and write the heck out of them. And yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think most, you know, and I'd hate for people to lose the opportunity. Like, I don't think it would be great for us if you were only allowed to write characters that very closely mapped on top of who you were.
Yeah.
That, you know, that would just be too bad. There's so many great writers out there who should write, you know, write every character. You know, like, my favorite writers, like, I look at these people and you're like, man, I just want you to write everybody. You know, like,
yeah,
every,
yeah,
book, every book I read by you is amazing. I want you to write all the books.
Yeah. 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 I mean, it's interesting though. I mean, we are coming into a place where it seems creators are much more interested and open to approaching characters that are sort of outside of their own experience. Because I mean, I feel like there have been a lot of artists kind of mainly probably mostly working in film, but novels and stuff like that, that really wrote very weak or uninteresting or female characters that were just used as sort of like quote unquote props, or just didn't write for them at all. And it seems like we're sort of reaching a place where people are, or writers, creators are much more open to exploring characters that are outside of their own experience, even if they might be a little uncomfortable with it.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. I mean, I think that's, you know, I think that's good for everybody, right? Yeah. I mean, you know, if you spend, you know, I guess it's the walk a mile in my shoes kind of idea. And even though it's, you were just talking about, you know, comic books or movies or film or whatever it is, yeah, I think there is something good. You know, I think it's the same way I remember when I was writing this book, and I was kind of nervous about, you know, was it good? Was it not? You know, I'm the kind of writer who always goes through those agonies of the damned, right? Like, sure. You know, on Monday, I'm like, wow, I'm really doing great work. And on Wednesday, I want to just like burn everything and tell IDW not to even bother because it all sucks.
No way. And I remember, you don't go through that. Do you really?
Oh yeah, for sure. For sure.
How do you push through those moments? Because you guys do great work.
You save the document, you turn off your computer, and you come back to it, you know, the next day, and you reread what, you know. I find like one of the best things for me when I'm writing at my best, I tend to read the 20 or so pages that I had just written, whether that was the previous couple of days or week or however long that took me. I reread those and I edit them as I go. And I find that doing that constant little tuning, A, hopefully makes the story better, but B, reminds me of like, oh yeah, there's stuff I like in this. And if there's stuff I'm not 100% happy with, that's fine. I'll find a way to make it something I like better. And you know, it's never going to be perfect. But I remember in this circumstance, I was, you know, I was writing Juliet and I don't know. I was in one of those places where I'm like, I'm not sure. Is this good? Is this not good? There's a bit at the end of the book where I'm still not 100% sure if I'm totally happy with how it worked out, but at a certain point you got to put it out there. And so I've got a daughter who's 4 years old. And so I remember, asking my wife, I'm like, well, like, do you think she'll be proud that her dad wrote this? Like when she's like 14, like if she reads Juliet, do you think she'll think it's pretty badass that her dad wrote this? Mm-hmm. And my wife was like, yeah, no, for sure. And she was like, if I was 14 and I was reading this Juliet, she's like, I would be like, this is an awesome book. And that made me feel really good. And I was like, okay, you know, that's all, you know, at the end of the day, that's, you know, I hope there are boys and girls. I hope there are a bunch of, whether you're 14 or 44, I hope there are a bunch of people who pick this up and are like, I like this Juliet. I'm behind her. I want to root for this character. I think she's great. She makes mistakes. She tries to overcome them. She inspires people. She makes them, you know, some things she does like have a huge impact, right? She has some really negative impacts on people's lives in this book, but that overall that you would sit here and be like, wow, okay. Like I want to root for this woman. You know, I'm really hoping people who have not read Kill Shakespeare will read Juliet first, then go back into the rest of the series and just be even more, like I said, Juliet's kind of our people's favorite character already. I hope they read this book and then go back in and are even just more jazzed about what Juliet's trying to do and her relationship with Hamlet and how they're trying to take on this big thing together. And I hope that feels even more powerful to them because they have this backstory and they're like, wow, this is how she got there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, if it helps, I mean, this actual volume of Juliet, I mean, my daughter's going on 11 in next several months, and she's still probably a little too young for this particular book. But when she's ready, it's definitely, I mean, she loves to read comic books. So this is something I definitely want to hand off to her. I think it was mostly sort of the Cornwall stuff towards the end where
it gets a little dark. It gets a little dark at the end, but
I mean, everything in this book, the artwork, you know, the story, the characterization and everything is something that I could see her just like falling in love with, you know, once she's old enough to sort of get her hands on it. And she's probably only like 2 or 3 years away in my imagination, because I mean, as shocking as it is to me, they grow up really fast. But, you know, I mean, I do think that, to answer your question, I think that, yes, I think any girl would, especially looking at the type of stuff that my daughter likes to read, you know, novels, books, you know, that sort of thing. She really is hung up on or really desires to have a strong female protagonist. And as sort of a comics fan, that's not something you can always find that easily. I mean, it's easier these days, but if you go back like into books that I was reading as a teenager, I'm like, I can't give her this. You know what I mean? Or even like early Wonder Woman books. I'm like, I can't give her this. It's just her like wooning over Steve Trevor. You know what I mean? But this book is definitely something that I would hand off to her and be like, you're going to love this.
Oh, thank you. That's pretty much the best compliment I can get, right? That's perfect. I really appreciate that. In the meantime, if you want to hand her my Adventure Time regular show comics, you might enjoy those.
A little more
bro orientated, but there's still some pretty good strong female characters in those two worlds.
I'm gonna have to. She hasn't really been exposed to those shows on like Cartoon Network. But the one thing that she's into is Teen Titans Go. Oh my god,
oh, yeah.
She's hardcore into that. But she hasn't made the sort of like voyage into the other stuff on that network. So I'll have to like help her drift over. I think Adventure Time, she's read some of those comics, but I think sometimes she's been like, that looks a little weird to me. So I don't know, but maybe I'll have to like.
Adventure Time, they were definitely out there with those. Those were fun. You know, that's something I was kind of doing parallel to the Juliet book.
Yeah.
And you know, I started off my career actually writing like a kid's feature film that I got some money for but never got made, and Anthony and I created a kids TV show together here in Toronto that got optioned and actually went into development here in Canada but also ultimately didn't see the screen.
Oh, wow.
And doing Adventure Time regular show was the first time in a long while that I kind of got back into the saddle of kind of writing for younger readers and forgot how much I'd really enjoyed it. And I'm actually now doing a 3-book series of hopefully at least 3 books of kind of YA adventure books, okay. Kind of, you know, not like Hunger Games, but more Faith Erin Hicksy type stuff.
Gotcha.
That I'm doing with Paper Cuts that I'm really looking forward to because I sort of forgot how much I enjoyed writing that. And actually, that script I was mentioning to you that I wrote with a good friend of mine, Magnum Street, years and years ago, we're now kind of repashing it perhaps as a graphic novel. So it's been weird to do. Juliet was so cool because it was so like it is a more mature story.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, you know, when I was getting, when, you know, the heavy parts of Juliet were feeling too heavy, I just got to dip into like watching Rigby and Jake from regular show and Adventure Time be like total doofuses and, you know, complete narcissists and, you know, screwing everything up around for everybody around them and, you know, just getting to write silly jokes and getting to laugh at myself, which was fantastic.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, on that note, what sort of, because it seems like, at least to me, or maybe I just wasn't paying attention, it seems to me that Kill Shakespeare took a little bit of a break at points, and you did go off and do other books like the Houdini Shakespeare book, which I loved, and I highly recommend that to anyone, you know, out there. Is that collected in trade?
Yeah, Sherlock Holmes, Harry Houdini is collected in trade and is through Dynamite.
Dynamite. Oh, okay. Yeah, I loved that book. That was a great book. And obviously the Assassin's Creed stuff. And I really have enjoyed, you know, the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew stuff that Anthony worked on. But did you feel like sort of a need to take a break from Kill Shakespeare? Were you getting a little burnt out on it? Or how did offers come in from other comic companies? Were you guys like, hey, we're looking to do something different? Or did people just come to you? How did all that stuff work out?
Oh, it was more people came to us. I mean, I think one thing I definitely learned in the last little while is a lot of people didn't realize, like, you know, they'd associated us with Kill Shakespeare, and it wasn't, I mean, the Hardy Boys or the Sherlock Holmes, Harry Houdini book was something that the Nick Barucci at Dynamite actually came to Anthony and I and was like, yeah, you know, we've got this specific interpretation of Holmes. We've got this visual, like the rights to this visual style. Cause I mean, Holmes is public domain, but there are elements of the character that are still kind of copyrightable.
Oh, really? I did not know.
And he was like, you know, I've always wanted to do something with Harry Houdini, you know, and have the two of them meet up. What do you think? And we were like, that's kind of a fun idea. But yeah. I think when people saw that, they sort of thought, oh, well, that's another creator-owned piece. As they didn't really think of us as people who would do work for hire. And it wasn't until Titan reached out to us. And so we did that. I mean, Nancy Drew, Hardy Boys is kind of both. I mean, Anthony's obviously working in a pre-existing license, but he was kind of came up with this brilliant idea of how to revitalize those two ideas. You know, funnily enough, parallel to what was going on with Archie, with Riverdale, Anthony was doing the same thing, and Riverdale comes out and he's sort of like, oh man, everybody's going to think I was just ripping off Riverdale.
Sure.
But no, he had, you know, he was in the same mindset as those guys were. So I think once those have come out, people have had a bit more of like, oh, you would do some other stuff. But I mean, and I would. I mean, hey, it's funny. I grew up as a huge Marvel fan, and I have one like contemporary Marvel pitch in my brain that I think would be a lot of fun to do. But weirdly enough, most of the pitches I would have for like superhero stuff would be for DC, and I wasn't as big a DC reader growing up, but there's just a couple of those characters that just keep banging around in my head and make me go, huh, that would be kind of fun if you did this with them. But, you know, I mean, I'd love to do more stuff for other companies. I actually really enjoy working in other people's sandboxes. I think there's a kind of a unique creative challenge of that. The old story about, hey, if you just told, you know, if I just say, hey, Christian, write me a story, oh gosh, that could be anything. But if I'm telling you, write me a story about, you know, a young boy, you know, trapped in a submarine with pirates, okay, great. You're going to get more ideas with those constraints than you will if I just let you write whatever you wanted to. And so that part is kind of fun. It's being told, okay, well, this is what the Adventure Time characters are, and this is what regular show is, or this is what we're trying to do in Assassin's Creed. And I think once we did Assassin's Creed, I think people maybe looked at us as like, oh, okay, they also do, you know, they'll also do licensed stuff. And then also I think people are going to get, either have to readjust again to like, oh, well, Anthony did the Hardy Boys thing and Connor wrote the most recent Kill Shakespeare on his own. And Anthony's got this new book that's going to be coming out in later in 2018. And Connor's got the first book of this 3-book series that's going to start coming out in 2019. And, you know, and they're going to kind of get used to the idea of, oh, you write separately, but yet you still come back together for Kill Shakespeare. And I think for the near future, that'll probably be how our career will look like. I think we'll continue to come back and play in the Kill Shakespeare sandbox together. And then we'll also go out and just kind of tell the types of stories we want to tell separately or with other people as well. And I think that's kind of one of the fun things about comics is you can kind of do that pretty easily because, hey, you know, at the end of the day, if you're writing comics, you can write your whole, you can write a series in a couple of months, and that gives you plenty of time to explore something else.
Sure. So with the Marvel and DC stuff, is that something that you, like, say, like you said, you had a couple of pitches bouncing around in your head. Is that something that, have they not approached you? How does that work? Are you at conventions and do you like swing by the DC booth and you're like, hey, here's my Kill Shakespeare, here's other stuff, I've got ideas for your characters, let's set up a meeting. How does all that stuff sort of play out? Because I mean, you said people approached you. Do they approach you at cons? Do they send you an email? How does all that work?
We're kind of emails and stuff like that. Like sometimes people might drop by a con. I'll say that for myself, I'm not as good at the swinging by. I'm horrible. When I'm in a con, I've got my table and I get this like intense like Catholic guilt if I like leave the table because I'm like, wow, I'm supposed to be at the table. I'm supposed to be selling these books. Sure. You know, Anthony and I, we're spending our own money to get to these things. He's busy working on a project back home. I should be behind the table.
Yeah.
He's much better. He's much better at sort of getting out there. But yeah, I mean, that's basically what you do need to do, right? You need to walk around and say, hey, you know, ideally, if there's somebody you know who says, yeah, this is the editor I know at Marvel, and you follow them on Twitter, or you know they're going to be at this con, and you drop by and you say, hey, you know, so-and-so here, I'm so-and-so's friend, it's nice to meet you. And yeah, you give them a copy of your book, and you let them know that you're available, and, you know, you try to build a relationship that way. You know, the Dynamite thing came because we met Nick Barucci actually when Kill Shakespeare was nominated for a Harvey Award. Dynamite was sitting at the same table and we started chatting with Nick, and that's how that happened. And Titan was kind of, they came out of nowhere to reach out to us. We weren't expecting that call at all. You know, Boom, the Adventure Time was because I'd been chatting with a different editor there over a couple of different projects, and we came close to a couple of times to something coming together, and then they just didn't happen. And then all of a sudden I got this call from a different editor saying, hey, I was chatting with my colleague and she thought you'd be great for this, and I read some of your Kill Shakespeare stuff and I really like your writing. Like, can you pitch me a couple of ideas for Adventure Time and regular show? Mm-hmm. So yeah, you never know how it happens. It's all weird, but definitely one of my New Year's resolutions is that the conventions I'm going to go to in the next year or two is to, you know, is to give myself permission to get out from behind that table and to do a little more selling of myself as opposed to just selling of the books. But you know, it'll be great having Juliet and having Adventure Time regular show will be useful. You know, just like it's great for Anthony to have Hardy Boys, is it makes it easy for people to be able to read Kill Shakespeare and then read something that he's done on his own or I've done on my own and be like, oh, hey, wow, they're both great writers in their own right. It's not like Anthony was carrying everybody, carrying Connor on his back, or vice versa. These guys are both really talented, and I could hire either one of them without worrying, oh my gosh, did I get the wrong one, kind of thing.
Yeah. No, I think that it's great. I mean, if you're out there listening, somebody at DC, get them on the line, because I would love to see like what you would come up with, because I've always loved all your work. So I just think that seeing you at DC or doing something and hopefully putting the overpants back on Superman for me would be wonderful, because that's what I want to see. But in any case, the one last question I want to ask you, because I've had you on for almost an hour, and you guys have always been super generous with your time, and you guys were actually my very first interview on this podcast. So
I didn't know that. That's cool.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you guys have always been very generous. But the thing that I've always been struck with is coming from someone who's not necessarily super organized in the things they do outside of, you know, their regular job, or doesn't necessarily have a plan, you guys always seem very well put together. Like, you know what you're doing, you know what's going on, you've got a plan, you have an idea of where you want to go. What sort of advice can you give to comic creators out there? How should they sort of have... what ducks should they have lined up in a row once they have developed their idea and like maybe even have artwork or something to go to someone? Like, how did you approach your first, I mean, this first project that actually kind of like, I'm imagining that it actually did launch your comic careers.
Yeah. I mean, there's a bunch of different ways to kind of skin the cat, but I mean, you know, what Anthony and I did for Kill Shakespeare, which we've kind of followed up for all our pitches, is, yeah, you know, we tried to have, you know, five or six really good pages of art that kind of summarizes the feel and the tone and the kind of the thrust of the story. You know, we've always tried to have, we've worked really hard at kind of developing like that one sentence log line or two sentence log line, so that, you know, because editors are busy. And I think one of the if you can't summarize your idea in one or two sentences in a way that's compelling, then you maybe you don't 100% know what your story is about.
Sure.
And in that case, it will probably do you a favor in the long term to keep fighting that log line. But, you know, at the end of the day, like, editors don't have a lot of time. So what I like to do with the pitch package is I like to have a cool logo on that first page with like a pithy, you know, four or five word sort of blurb about it. And then the next page, I like to just have all white space with like a log line and then maybe a one paragraph summary, so that if nothing else, I feel like I can get an editor to look at two pages. And if there's something interesting visually on the first page with the logo, and then there's a very short thing he or she can read in, you know, less than a minute, if that interests them, then great. Turn the page, and then there's going to be actual art and pages coming next. And I feel like that's kind of the best, because at that point, then they want to see the art. They want to see how the story is going to get told. They're going to want to see what the feel is. And, you know, at that point, she can make a decision whether she wants to read more about the characters and the world, you know, because at that point, she's like, okay, I feel like the idea behind the story is interesting, and I feel like the art is cool, and I'm invested to keep going. And I think, you know, I think if you can focus on doing that, those first like two or three sections really well, it'll give you opportunities. And, you know, I've definitely had situations where I've had people be like, I love this pitch, it's not right for us, but please keep pitching, because the pitch is easy for them to read and it draws them into the world. And, you know, and that's part of the challenge. It's, you know, it's pitch to as many people as you can. Don't be afraid. You know, this series I'm doing, this YA adventure series, you know, I pitched it all over and I got a lot of close no's, and then eventually it found the right home. And, you know, you can't get frustrated when you know, when it takes some time, like Kill Shakespeare was like, we got 5 offers on the, after we walked out for the very first time. And I've never had that experience since then. I'm pretty sure Anthony's never had that experience either. Like, it's hard work. It's hard work getting it out there. But practicing your pitching and figuring out that 1 or 2 lines is, I think, probably the best thing you can do, because it just makes every interaction so quick. You can go to an editor, be like, hey, this is my story, hit him with a couple of lines, and then just be quiet and let them react, you know, and rather than overwhelming them with like, oh, then this happens and this happens. Sure. You know, that never works.
Sure, sure. Well, I have to say, I love this book. Thank you so much for keeping me on your mailing list. I have been paying attention, even though I haven't been in touch or we haven't done an interview in like 3 years, but you guys are busy. Everyone's busy, but I really did love Kill Shakespeare past his prologue, Juliet. I think it's fantastic. Everything from the writing to the art is just, it's just a great little package. And I really do look forward to the next chapter, which do you think you're coming out with one next year?
I don't think the next book would be out next year, but my hope is that we'll be well into production of a book, so that something would be coming out like kind of sometime in 2019 is my hope, but we'll see. I mean, you never know, right? Sometimes things move more quickly than you realize.
You never know. Well, whatever you guys do, please keep me informed. I love all your stuff. I've really enjoyed your work, and you guys have both been extremely generous and kind with your time. And you guys are always super nice to me when we run into each other at conventions. It's always like, hey, Christian. And I'm like, wow. I mean, honestly, you're the friendliest guys at cons, because I'm like, I feel like Norm just walked into Cheers or something. I'm like, holy cow, that's great. But thank you so much for your time. And I really appreciate you carving out an hour for me. And just thanks for all your work, because I really do love it.
Well, thanks, Christian. I really appreciate it. And, you know, it's the Canadian in us. You know, we got to be nice.
It must be. Well, my name is Christian Horn. This has been the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. I have been on the line with Connor McCreary. Anthony Del Cole was not available to join us, but that's his problem. Thank you so much, Connor. I really appreciate your time, and thank you for listening to Part-Time Fanboy. Check us out on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, Instagram, all that good stuff, or you can email us at ptf@parttimefanboy.com. Thanks for listening, and we will see you soon with another episode. Bye.
Fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
I'm doing part-time.